So, in the previous session, I briefly spoke of the social and cultural context of the 19th century. It's a time of industrialization, of intense population growth, and rapid urbanization. This also implied the first ecological problems on a truly modern scale, such as, for instance, the Great Stink. It's peculiarly named phenomenon which took place in London in 1858 when there was a heat wave in England. Now the hot weather worsened the smell of untreated human waste and industrial waste that was present on the banks of the River Thames. The problem was that the city's sewer system was old and inadequate, and this would eventually lead to the construction of a modern sewer system in London. By the way, The bad smell for many people was an indication of the presence of disease. And for instance, when a few weeks later there was a cholera outbreak in London, it was blamed on the bad air coming from the untreated human waste and industrial waste. Still, at this time, there was a great belief in the powers of technology. Technology and science would be able to solve this kind of problems. And that is why this age came to be known as the Age of Reason. There was this quite naive belief that science will be able to solve any problem that human civilization would ever run into. And this belief is called scientism. Not only the natural sciences benefited from this culture of scientism, but also the humanities, the human sciences. The 19th century is the cradle of modern sociology and psychology. I already talked about this in our last session, but also of modern sciences such as archaeology, history, and linguistics. I'm now talking about history, not in the ancient sense of the word. As you know, already in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, you have historians writing historical books, but what I'm here talking about is scientific history. So history as a scientific discipline with a certain kind of rigor, with a certain kind of necessity to document your sources, with a culture of reference, not just making things up, but actually documenting your research. And this scientific understanding of history only originated in the 19th century. So in the 19th century, we see an enormous expansion of knowledge. It literally becomes impossible, to contain this knowledge within a single building. This is, for example, the problem that the New York Public Library was trying to solve. This beautiful building, you might know it if you have been to New York already. It's this beautiful building on Fifth Avenue with the lions in front of the entrance. But it's a beautiful building, but the important part is actually underground. Because this building was constructed at the beginning of the 20th century, and it actually embodied the 19th century culture of knowledge. It embodied this new necessity for documenting knowledge and storing knowledge, which was actually growing a bit out of hand, which was almost uncontainable. So underground, the New York Public Library, you have no less than 7 underground floors to house all of the books. The New York Public Library was actually designed to house the collections of all the pre-existing New York public libraries. And so in total, there's 120 kilometers of book racks, bookshelves, in the underground floors of the New York Public Library. Currently, the library is holding 53 million volumes. And this gives you an impression of the scale at which knowledge is growing during the 19th century. It gave rise to some very original ideas. In Belgium, for instance, 2 information scientists had a different idea, different from the New York Public Library. They constructed a new kind of institution. They called it the Mundaneum. Mundaneum literally means the museum of the world, and you can see it as a kind of prehistoric ancestor to modern-day search engines like Google, for instance, or DuckDuckGo. The Mundaneum was not a library itself, it was not a museum itself, but it was a library of libraries. This meant This means that if you had a question, you could ask it to the staff of the Mandaneum and they would be able to tell you in which library or museum or archive you would be able to find your answer. It's like Google search, but then by postcard. It's not a coincidence, by the way, that there is a new Mandaneum today. It's located in the city of Mons, Belgian city of Mons, Bergen. And this new Mandaneum was financed by Google. Okay, so particularly the interest in history. I talked about the new emergence of human sciences like history, and particularly the interest in history had much to do with general cultural factors. I want to say a few words about that. As you know, colonialism had caused Europe to be flooded with objects imported from exotic cultures and ancient cultures. Not only was Napoleon plundering the treasures of the East during his campaign in Egypt, but the Brits and the Germans were eagerly doing the same. Think of the many art treasures that arrived in Western museums around this time and which remain controversial to this very day. Think of the famous Elgin marbles from the Acropolis, which are now housed in London, the British Museum. Think of the obelisk of Luxor standing in Paris. Think of the Gate of Ishtar from ancient Iraq, ancient Mesopotamia, now housed in Berlin. Think of the Egyptian Mosque of Nefertiti, also housed in Berlin in the Neues Museum. There's so much that Europeans stole from the East and from African countries during this period, during the 19th and early 20th century. By the way, there's a nice anecdote about the bust of Nefertiti in the Neues Museum in Berlin. The bust has been there since its discovery by the German archaeologist Ludwig Borchardt in 1912. And Egypt has continued to request the artifact's return, but with very little success. And so in 2016, there was this protest, this digital theft, you could say, of the Nefertiti bust. Two young artists, Nora Albatri and Jan Nicolai Nellis, claimed that they had snuck a 3D scanner into the museum and they had used it to create a digital 3D model of the artifact, which they released online. It's like this virtual liberation of Nefertiti. Now, their story was criticized by experts because the scan was simply of too high quality to be made with an improvised scanner. And it looked too much like the real 3D scan made previously by the museum itself. And that set in motion a process which caused some of these experts to force the Neues Museum to release the original digital files of their own scans. And eventually it happened, and now everyone can make their own Nefertiti at home. You can look up the scans using a search engine, using Google or DuckDuckGo. You can search for digital Nefertiti 3D scan and you will find it. You can print out, 3D print your own Nefertiti. You will see that in the digital file there is still digitally etched into the model, there is a copyright claim by the museum, which is of course quite dubious. How can you copyright something that you stole from the Egyptians 100 years ago? Well, as you see, we're still living, you could say, in a world shaped culturally then, a world shaped by the 19th century. And let's go back to that 19th century now. 19th century man experienced the very old as being very close to them. So the emergence of archaeology as a new academic discipline was inspired by this widespread interest in history. In architecture, the French architect Eugène Viollet-le-Duc popularized an empathic style of restoring medieval buildings. He believed that the architect should bring the past back to life in the most optimal way, even though the resulting building had never historically really existed. This point of view led to many neo-styles, such as the Gothic Revival. A very good example of the Gothic Revival is the famous Westminster Palace in London, which you will know from television probably, or from having visited yourself. It's where the British Parliament is housed. And it also houses Big Ben Tower. It's the most famous building in London. I think it's a prime example of this Gothic Revival style. If you look at it at first sight, you think it must be a medieval building. Not at all. A small part of it is actually medieval, Westminster Abbey. But then in the 19th century, they decided to build something medieval-like, Gothic-like, and they made it into this huge complex built entirely with modern building materials and modern building techniques such as steel and concrete, but it looks from the outside medieval. It looks Gothic. That's a perfect example of the so-called Gothic Revival. Also in our country, in Flemish cities like Bruges and Ghent, there were intensive restoration campaigns to make them again look truly medieval. Think of, for instance, in this city, the Grote Markt in Antwerp, many of the historical buildings that you see there are actually 19th century reconstructions. By the way, interesting anecdote, it is this same architect, Eugène Viollet-le-Duc, who made the plans for the spire of Notre Dame in Paris, which collapsed during the fire in April 2019, now exactly 1 year ago. Viollet-le-Duc was the chief architect of the reconstruction of the cathedral around the middle of the 19th century. He wanted it to be more Gothic than Gothic, so the spire that he built was actually higher than it had originally been intended in the Middle Ages, and this might have been one of the reasons that it actually collapsed as a result of the fire. So, this kind of historicizing architecture was one expression of the 19th century's obsession with history. Obviously, not the only one. And another good example of this historic obsession is the emergence of the modern science of archaeology, which I already referred to. You get the first large-scale excavation, and they drew much attention. A very famous example was the search for the presumed remains of ancient Troy near the Turkish city of Hisarlik, which was initiated by Heinrich Schliemann. Schliemann was a very rich German gentleman who decided to put his personal fortune into this enormous excavation expedition. There is a photograph, a famous photograph of the Greek wife of Schliemann, Sophia Schliemann, who is posing with some of the historical jewels that were found during the excavation. And afterwards, this has been the topic of much criticism and discussion, because what Schliemann found there, part of it could indeed belong to the ancient city of Troy, but he dug up so much that it actually belongs to various time eras, to various periods of time, historical periods of time. So what the jewels that she is posing with on the picture are probably not Trojan in origin. They could very well be from a much earlier period or a much later period. But I like the image very much because, in a nutshell, it typifies the 19th century approach to the past. The 19th century people wanted to have the past as close to their skin as possible. And you almost see it literally in the picture of Sophia Schliemann. Ancient cultures brought closer by archaeology, just like non-Western cultures brought closer by colonialism, constituted a whole new research object for scholars. And as a consequence, philosophers began to question the foundations of the new scientific disciplines, such as archaeology, historiography, and ethnography. Was there a difference, they asked, between the knowledge provided by an astronomical observation and the knowledge provided by an ancient Greek vase? The German philosopher Wilhelm Dilthey believed that this was the case, and he was one of the very first to ask himself these questions. So let's have a look at Dilthey's philosophies of science now. In his book Introduction to the Humanities, Einleitung in die Geisteswissenschaften from 1883, Dilthey campaigned for a separate status for the knowledge produced by the humanities. I will use this word humanities as a shorthand for indicating history, linguistics, archaeology, art history, literary history, and so on. So this kind of knowledge he said, has earned a rightful place alongside natural sciences, but its source, the source of this knowledge, is fundamentally different. The work of a historian is not like that of the scientist. A natural scientist tries to explain natural phenomena by detecting the underlying laws of nature. That's what he does. That's what an astronomer does. That's what a physicist does, or a chemist. Now, for this kind of explaining, Dilthey used the word erklären in German, explain. And he said this type of activity, of mental activity, is different from what a historian tries to do. A historian strives to understand human or cultural phenomena using his or her empathy. And for this kind of activity, Dilthey did not use the word erklären, explaining, but the word verstehen, or understanding. And there's a crucial difference, according to Dilthey, between the two kinds of knowledge. Let me quote him on this. We explain nature, but we understand the life of the soul. In the original German, it's like this. Die Natur erklären wir, das Seelenleben verstehen wir. End of quote. It's a crucial difference. Let me try to be a little more explicit about it. Let me try to explain it a little more. It means that the knowledge produced by the humanities, by historians, by art historians, literary critics, or archaeologists, can never be absolutely objective. When you are studying a prehistoric spearhead, or an ancient Greek temple, or a 16th century theater play, you as a researcher have no choice but to use your empathy. When it comes to human culture and psychology, you also have an inner experience of these phenomena, and that is decisive. The natural scientist, on the other hand, only has an outer experience. He does not know what gravity works like from the inside. You cannot empathize with gravity. You cannot empathize with a black hole. You have to understand it strictly from the outside, using your powers of observation. But when you're trying to understand human phenomena, human culture, human history, you try to empathize with the people that you are studying, even if they lived thousands of years ago. And the kind of outer experience that you have of these historical phenomena is mostly irrelevant. For instance, imagine a law historian who would identify the exact dimensions and construction techniques of a court building. That would be exact knowledge about the history of law, but it would be completely irrelevant. It would have nothing to do with the practice of law taking place inside that building. In order to come closer to the historical practice of law, you will need to read a lot of historical documents and then use your empathy to get inside that historical spirit. According to Dilthey, a scholar of culture does not attempt to explain the object of his research by means of natural laws, but to interpret or understand it based on his own human experience. He tries to re-experience the human experiences reflected in the cultural products he is studying. He tries to nacherleben. He wants to re-experience them and to supplement these experiences from his own life experience. So, the musicologist relates personally to the music he or she is studying. The literary historian relates personally to the historical literary works he or she is studying. And the archaeologist relates personally to the ancient civilizations he or she is studying. Inevitably so. Specifically for the study of art, Dilthey believed that the researcher's own aesthetic experience was a vital part of the research process. He defended this view in his book Poetry and Experience, Das Erlebnis und die Dichtung in German, a collection of essays on literature from 1905. This book contains an essay on Goethe and poetic fantasy, Goethe und die dichterische Fantasie in German, written in the year 1877. In the essay, Dilthey is developing a philosophical understanding of the aesthetic experience. In doing so, he must position aesthetic knowledge vis-à-vis scientific knowledge. The second kind of knowledge had become dominant over the course of the previous centuries. His concept of the aesthetic experience is therefore modeled on that of scientific knowledge. So, let me now switch from Dilthey's philosophy of science to his philosophy of art. Let me try to explain how Dilthey positions aesthetic experience in an opposition with scientific knowledge. And in doing so, we will be able to elucidate the structure of aesthetic experience. This is the topic that Dilthey has become famous for his analysis of the structure of aesthetic experience. Now, to do so, I would first like to focus on the concept of experience, or in German, Erlebnis. Dilthey is one of the first thinkers to use this word and apply it to art, and one of the first to give it such a central role in his theory of art. What exactly is an experience, eine Erlebnis? Dilthey starts by pointing out that an experience is not just given to us. He says, die Erfahrung ist uns nicht gegeben. The experience is not given to us. It is not available to us as an object to think about. It is not a thing that is always available for contemplation. Only during thinking about an experience does something become an experience. In other words, it becomes understandable as such, as a thing. It becomes conceived as an experience, eine Erlebnis, this separate part of sensations, this constellation of sensations that I am now designating as an experience. Only when I'm thinking about it consciously does it become an experience. Otherwise, it's just floating. It's not really, I can't really pinpoint it. It's just, it's subsumed in the cloud of all of my sensations. I'm getting a bit foggy here. So let me briefly quote Dilthey himself on this. And I quote, experience is a differently characterized way in which reality is there for me. The experience does not come to me as something perceived or imagined. It is not given to us. But the thing, experience, is there for us in that we become aware of it, that I possess it directly as belonging to me in some sense. Only in thinking does the experience become objective. Erst im Denken wird es gegenständlich. Only when I'm thinking about the experience does the experience become a thing. A Gegenstand. Okay, now let me distinguish between scientific observation and an aesthetic experience. The scientific observer stands in an inquisitive relation to the external world. The creative artist also stands in a relation to the external world. However, in order to distinguish the aesthetic from the scientific relations, Dilthey adds a third term. While standing in relation to the external world, the artist simultaneously stands in relation to his own self, which experiences this reality. His experience, his Erlebnis, is reflected in his work only after it has passed through the filter of imagination, Fantasie, and artistic design, Gestaltung. This is, of course, absent in the case of a scientific observation. We expect a scientist not to use his or her imagination, personality, and personal design choices. On the contrary, if you're a scientist and you're doing a scientific observation, it should be the same observation, regardless of whether you're old or young, male or female, feeling depressed or feeling in love, etc. I even made a diagram of this. You can find it in the slides, where I try to juxtapose the structure of a scientific observation with the structure of an aesthetic experience. And you will see that in the scientific observation, there's one crucial relationship missing, namely the relationship, the personal relationship between the scientist and his or her scientific report. There should be no personal involvement. The scientific report should be an objective, impersonal, reflection of what the scientist has observed in the external reality. Now, let me go into a little more detail and try to explain to you what Dilthey named as the basis, what's the substrate for this process of aesthetic experience. And here, Dilthey is in dangerous waters because he cannot fully extend the analogy with science. He cannot hold, as with science, that nature lies at the basis of the aesthetic experience. The artist's self plays too important a role. Neither can Dilthey introduce a universal notion of beauty or a standard of good taste. When Dilthey was writing in 1877, art had already become a completely autonomous system. Half a century earlier, Hegel might still have fostered the enormous ambition of focusing one philosophical mission on the entirety of the arts, but in Dilthey's time, this could no longer convince. Art and literature were autonomous and were seen to have many faces, many social roles that they were playing. Substrate that Dilthey introduces is possibly an even more general term than nature. It's life. He argues that poetry is the representation and expression of life. I have to make one small note here. Dilthey's essay is about poetry in the strict sense of the word, but I believe it's also applicable to art in general. So it's not just applicable to literature, but also to the visual arts and to music. So he writes, Poesie ist Darstellung und Ausdruck des Lebens. Poetry is the representation and expression of life. How do you have to understand this? Poetry is the representation of life, yes, because the poet is always telling me about some part of life. Some part of the world is represented in the work of art, in the poem. But simultaneously, it's also an expression of life. The poet's life is expressed in the artwork. It's not just a mirror of daily life, a mirror of the world. It's also an expression of how the poet has experienced that world. To put it in other words, the experience of the artist can only be expressed in the artwork after it has gone through the filter of the artist's imagination and design. Now, there's a very nice quote from the German poet, from the American, not German poet, Wallace Stevens, that stresses the importance of personal experience in the process of writing poetry. Wallace Stevens writes the following, and I quote, "The collecting of poetry from one's experience as one goes along is not the same as merely writing poetry." End of quote. I think this is quite, it makes quite clear that for Wallace Stevens it was necessary to ground the writing of poetry in one's personal experience. And this is even essential. Without this personal experience, there is no real poetry. It's just words that have been made nice, but no real poetry. Now, let me turn to the observer. So far, I have only discussed the role of the productive side, the artist himself or herself, or the poet or the composer. How does it work on the receiving end for the viewer, the listener, the reader? What happens when I see a work of art or when I read a work of poetry or hear a piece of music, is that I see the representation of a fragment of life, but I also feel the expression of the artist's own life through the work. The viewer or reader or listener immediately absorbs that fragment of life. You touch the experience of the artist who has chosen that particular expression. To watch, to read, or listen to art is an enriching experience, a new Erlebnis. And this for Dilthey is the reason why art is so important and why we like art so much. Every poetic work, every work of art enhances the reader's feeling of human existence. And Dilthey uses a very special German word for this. It's the word Daseinsgefühl. Daseinsgefühl is one of those German words that you can only translate with multiple English words because it's a bit complicated. Dasein means existence, and Gefühl is obviously emotion, feeling. So Daseinsgefühl would translate the feeling of being alive. So when I read, when I listen to music, when I look at visual art, I may not become a better person. That's what the Enlightenment philosophers had believed. But I will become more human. I will become more human. Why do we read poetry? Why do we listen to music? Why do we watch paintings? Well, Dilthey says, we do so in order to know what it is like not to be the person who I am. We do so to know what it is like to be someone else entirely. And the interesting thing is that this theory of Dilthey, which is almost 150 years old, has a connection with contemporary theories of art. For instance, psychological research nowadays concentrates on the impact of art. Let me here just refer to the research project of psychologists David Comer Kidd and Emanuelo Castano. They have done work at the New School for Social Research in New York, and they have demonstrated that reading literary fiction enhances the ability to detect and understand other people's emotions. So there is, and this is stronger in the case of literary fiction than in the case of popular fiction or nonfiction. So there is a clear connection between literature as a genre and how we understand human psychology. Okay, let's go back to Dilthey. By formulating both the production and the reception of the work in terms of experience, Dilthey implicitly gives a definition of art and literature. The reader relives the experience as it was lived by the artist before him, and which has been translated, you could say, into the artwork. Now, the task of art critics and art historians is to clarify how this translation took place. In other words, they have to understand understanding. Because of their training or talent, critics are a kind of ideal observers, able to provide better access to the way in which the artist has understood and experienced reality. Critics must outline as accurately as they can the triangle formed by, on the first hand, the experience of the artist, of, secondly, the external reality in which the artist was situated, and thirdly, the expression of these, so both the artist's own experience and the external reality, in the artwork. The strength of Dilthey's approach is that from this moment onwards, all scholars of art and literature had to account for their own aesthetic experience and how it had colored their analysis. No longer could one invoke uncritically the so-called eternal laws of art or those of universal aesthetic experience. From now on, from Dilthey's theory onwards, art and aesthetics were riveted to the observer. A weakness of his approach is that in his attempt to distinguish the aesthetic outlook as sharply as possible from the scientific outlook, his system nevertheless remains structurally bound to that scientific outlook. Dilthey indeed claims that the aesthetic experience is a very specific kind of human experience, different from objective knowledge, but the very template that he uses is based on the epistemology of science. He conceives art like science as a system in which man and reality are interconnected as communicating vessels. So external reality, for instance, still plays a very important role for Dilthey in art. The depiction of external reality is very important. And of course today, after all the revolutions of 20th century art, we can have our questions regarding that focus. Good. Now, let me formulate some of these points in his own words, as a way of concluding this podcast of today. Poetry is the representation and expression of life. It expresses lived experience and represents the external reality of life. I, the writer, will try to evoke the main aspects of life in the memory of my reader. In life, my own self and its milieu are given to me, also a feeling of my existence, a mode of conduct, and an attitude toward the people and things around me. These exert pressure on me, or offer me strength and pleasure. They make demands on me and occupy a place in my existence. Thus, each thing or each person receives a particular force and coloring from its relations to my life. The finitude of existence, bounded by birth and death and restricted by the pressure of reality, awakens in me the longing for something enduring, changeless, and withdrawn from the pressure of things. And when I look up to the stars, they become for me the symbol of such an external, untouchable world. In everything surrounding me, I re-experience that which I myself have experienced. At dusk, I look down upon a quiet town at my feet. The lights appearing one after another in the houses below are to me the expression of a secure, tranquil existence. The life I find in my own self, my situations, and the people and things around me constitutes their life value, in contrast to the values they receive through their effects. It is this life value that the literary work shows first of all. Its object is not reality as discerned by the intellect, but rather my own state and the state of things as manifested in life relations. End of the first quote. Now let me move to the second quote. Only now can we grasp the nature of the poetic imagination. Up to this point, we have merely discussed the general conditions of the poetic imagination, which integrates all the psychic processes whereby the poetic world is given shape. These psychic processes are always rooted in lived experiences and the substratum of perception fashioned by them. Lived relations govern the poetic imagination and come to expression in it, just as they have already influenced the perceptions in the poet. Here, involuntary and imperceptible processes prevail. These processes constantly affect the color and form of the world in which the poet lives. This is the point at which the connection between lived experience and imagination in the poet begins to reveal itself. The poetic world is there before any particular event inspires the poet with the conception of a work and before he writes down its first line. The process in which the poetic world arises and a particular literary work is constituted derives its law from an attitude to the reality of life, which is completely different from the relation of elements of experience to a system of knowledge. The poet lives in a wealth of experiences of the human world as he finds it in himself and discovers it outside himself. For him, these experiential facts are not data from which he extracts generalizations, nor are they used to satisfy his system of needs. The poet's eye concentrates on them calmly and reflectively. They are significant to him. They arouse his feelings, sometimes gently, sometimes powerfully. However distant in the past or remote from his own interests these facts may be, they are part of himself. The imagination produces figures or characters which are, within certain limits, like real persons. Thus, Dickens lived with his characters as with people like himself. He suffered with them as catastrophe befell them and feared the moment of their demise. Balzac spoke of the characters of his Comédie Humaine as if they lived. He analyzed, praised and blamed them as if they belonged together with him to the same respectable society. He could conduct long debates about what they ought to do in a particular situation. Thus, poetry opens up our understanding of life. Through the eyes of the great poets, we perceive the value and connectedness of things human. End of quote. So, thank you very much for listening, and I'll hope to hear you again next week. Bye.